this kind of unconscious processes, but you can also call it and talk about it as groupthink and group conformity. And I think that what happens is that the group uses defense mechanisms, unconscious defense mechanisms, as like denial or splitting or idealization or repression, and so you need to help the manager and the group to sort of tolerate the anxiety, to face the facts.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org.
Welcome, everyone, to today's podcast. I'm Dr. Stephen Rolfe. I'm an analyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia and chair of the American Psychoanalytic Association's Committee on Corporate and Organizational Consulting. I'm managing principal of Rolfe Advisory and Sante Advisory and specialize in psychodynamic leadership advisory services for CEOs, business owners, and leaders in crisis. Today's guest is Dr. Anna Krantz. Dr. Krantz is a psychologist and psychoanalyst in private practice in Stockholm, Sweden. She began her work consulting to organizations in the late 1990s and early 2000s when, after working to improve selection and hiring processes in organizations, she introduced employee assistance programs and critical incident management to the Swedish market. Her more recent experience, which we will hear more about presently, is in conjunction with St. Luke's in Stockholm, where her interest is in helping leaders and teams function more productively and effectively. Her focus is paying close attention to unacknowledged and unconscious dynamic factors in groups that interfere with the group's optimal functioning. Anna, welcome to our podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. Perhaps we could begin by your telling us a bit about your practice in general.
I work part-time as an analyst with mostly it's psychotherapeutical work. It's psychoanalytical psychotherapy because it's hard to get analysts. So mostly two times a week. And then I'm working at the St. Luke Institution in Stockholm, 75% of my time. So that's what I'm doing right now.
And I understand the organizational work that you're doing is in conjunction with St. Luke.
Yes, yeah. I've been working at St. Luke for 4 years. And so before I worked many years in two other companies. And what I did there was I became interested in EAP, employee assistance programs, and also critical incident work. So I worked with that for many years. And then I started, as I said, at St. Luke 4 years ago. And my main work there is with leaders, organizations, groups, and also teaching.
So let me take a step back hear a little bit about how you got interested at first in doing organizational work.
Well, yeah, I started off in the psychiatry, in a psychiatry ward, and it was quite difficult to work there as a psychologist. I didn't have my psychoanalytical training by then. So I worked as a psychologist, and the psychologist then had very little power over the work, the treatment. We were much in the hands of psychiatrists, and it was pretty frustrating. So I decided when I moved to Stockholm, when I got into the psychoanalytical training program, that I didn't want to work in the psychiatry. So I had some help to find something else. And then I found this little family business with very psychodynamic psychologists. And then I got hired there. And then I worked a lot with selection of, you know, managers. And of course, we had a big job, a big merger between two banks. I got into that, and also after a while, we started this EAP thing, because we didn't have that before in Sweden at all. We sort of imported EAP to Sweden, this little family business. So it was mostly work with the EAP's things. And then I moved to another company working in healthcare for companies and so on, traditional healthcare, working a lot with organizational analysis and also coaching managers and so on. So I did pretty much the same as I do there in that ordinary organization as I do now at St. Luke. But St. Luke is a non-profit organization, so it's a little bit different, so to speak. And we have a lot of customers who are also non-profit organizations.
Yeah, maybe you could tell our audience a bit more about St. Luke's in general, because from what I know about it, it's a really unique place.
It has always been a non-profit organization, and it started was three, a priest, a doctor, and a social worker got together 80 years ago and said that we need to create something to speak, to have conversation. It was in the beginning of the psychotherapeutic movement in Sweden. This was 80 years ago. It sort of started with, we had, of course, a small psychoanalytical association by then. And this was very pretty closely in the beginning linked to psychoanalysis. But now it's all the mainstream, you know, CBT and psychodynamic psychotherapy. And so it's mixed up. So we are, yeah, a lot of different kind of psychotherapists working there right now. And it's all over Sweden.
I see. So were analysts involved initially in its in the beginnings?
Yes, because there were only psychoanalysis. The CBT movement came later to Sweden, as in every other. We didn't have almost any behaviorists in Sweden by then. They came much later. The psychoanalysis dominated the academic world and the therapeutic world. So behaviorism and CBT came much later, you can say so, yeah.
So St. Luke's is a large organization with many different sites and many different kinds of therapies.
Yes, it's a perfect mix between psychodynamic psychotherapy and CBT, and now also in some sites, organizational work, like for instance in Stockholm and on 2-3 other sites in Sweden, we work with the organizations.
And this is where you do your organizational work then?
Yeah, this is where I do. So we are a team at our site. We are four of us working with this, one of which is our manager, so to speak. She doesn't have a lot of time to work with that nowadays. But three of us works a lot with organizations.
Give us a sense of the kinds of organizations that you work with and how you work with these organizations as a team.
Sometimes it's just small things. It can be a conflict where you just work as a mediator. So that's a small work to facilitate to be a mediator in conflicts between maybe two employees, or between a boss and an employee. Or It could be to be a facilitator in workshops or the learning stuff, to help a group grow, to develop a group, help developing a group. This is one thing. And then another thing that we do a lot is to do this kind of analysis. There is something happening. They don't know really what. They call us and we go interview employees and the managers, of course, to try to get to what is the problem here, what kind of help do you need, so on, to make some sort of investigation.
And you're always working together with a team of professionals.
When we do the organizational analysis, we are always two, or maybe if it's a big job, three or more. But it's very important to have a co-worker in that work, because it's quite tricky sometimes to keep your head cold, so to speak, and to have always someone to talk with and try to understand, because there are some pretty heavy processes going on that people want to push you either way, and so you have to always keep your head calm and be able to think. So yeah, it's important to have that other co-worker. Yes.
So I think one of the things that we've noticed in doing these podcasts and listening to the kind of work that people are doing, that it takes the skill of not only working with the client, but also working as you do with other professionals in the system. I'm wondering if you could say something about what you as an analyst in particular bring to both working with your other professionals who aren't analysts, as well as the work with the client, him or herself.
Yeah, so when we meet an organization that has problems, it's like to be aware of that there is a sort of collective dynamic unconscious going on in the group. It's an unconscious level in that culture, in the organization. So this is the first thing that I always think about, and when I meet a new organization that has troubles. And I also explain to the managers and the group that we have these different kind of levels that we need to address. So we do the deep interviews with, say, if it's a group, 20 employees, including the managers. You do the deep interviews, and then you can sort of also catch something of the unconscious material that's going on in the organization. And the analyst that I have a lot of help from is, of course, Wilfred Bion. He, as everybody knows, worked with groups, and not very many psychoanalysts work with groups. So he's sort of not the only, but he's someone who you can identify with as an analyst working with groups, who has had some major impact, influence in the organization or world. But psychoanalysis is not really it's marginalized.
So your focus is on the unconscious process that is going on in the group.
Bion calls it the basic assumption, groupthink, fight, flight, or dependency, this kind of unconscious processes. But you can also call it and talk about it as groupthink and group conformity. And I think that what happens is that the group uses defense mechanisms, unconscious defense mechanisms, as like denial or splitting or idealization or repression, of course. And so you need to help the manager and the group to sort of tolerate the anxiety, to face the facts in the reality, and and especially facts that are not appreciated, not welcomed. So it's that kind of sort of not very nice things you have to say sometimes to manage, to the manager or to the group or to the process owner, because we always, when we go out and do these interviews and analysis, we need to have the process owner as the owner of the process, not the manager, because the manager is involved in the group, in the destructive group processes. So it needs to be someone out of the system. That's very, very important.
Can you say more about that when you're talking about someone outside the process?
Yeah. So when you meet a group, a working group, and you have the manager and you have the group, and there's stuff going on, bad stuff, maybe bullying, maybe other destructive processes, misunderstanding, conflicts, role conflicts, things that are unclear, roles that are unclear, goals that are unclear, you really need to have the process owner outside the group. That's crucial, because you cannot sort of give the feedback only to the manager, because then maybe he or she will just hide it away, because it's great pain to see things and to have that feedback. I mean, it's tough sometimes, and sometimes the process owner, that is the HR or the manager's manager, or somebody who has the power to sometimes make decisions that are crucial for the group, for the work group to move forward. That's really crucial. And always the process owner owns the decisions. I am not the stand-in manager or expert. It's always the others who are experts. Of course, I'm just the consultant. I'm just somebody who sees things, who can be able to think when the group or the manager is not able to think, because they are sort of entrenched in difficult group process. And it can happen anyone. This is not because they are not intelligent, or because we know that this can happen to the best of us. It's normal processes in groups going on.
But are you saying that when you're working with a group, you'll have the manager outside of the group in order for the group to be able to speak more openly, or?
Oh yes, we interview each one of the employees in the deep semi-structured interviews to really try to get to the core of the problems. We also, of course, interview the manager herself or himself, because he or she is actually part of the group. And then we give the feedback first to the process owner, who might be the manager's manager, or this whoever is in charge, whoever has the power to decide stuff in the group. So we give the feedback when we've done it, the analysis. We give the feedback first to the process owner, and then to the process owner together with the manager, and then the whole group. So they have the same feedback.
So could we hear about a case example where you used this process successfully, or maybe even not so successfully with the group?
Sometimes it's like what Bion says, making the best of a bad job. It's like damage control. So this is a typical, very typical example of what can happen. This is a job I did several years ago. It's a small town in the south of Sweden. It's a store selling software products, having a big business group all over Sweden, with a headquarter in Stockholm. There was a crisis in this shop, in this location, because one of the employees actually recorded a dialogue or a discussion with her boss, and had some help from the union. And this was a crisis in the organization, and they couldn't handle it themselves, because when the HR people listened to the tape that she sent to them, there was a conflict in that HR department. So they wanted somebody from the outside to come to do the work. So this was typically you pose the questions about the structure. Is the structure okay? You know, everything that has to do with the hard, is there a common goal? What about the roles? What about the communication? What about the, all that kind of stuff? And in this particular workplace, all that was fine. Everything was clear about the structure. It was in the culture. First, they had the workload was too high, and the leadership, they had some leadership issues because the former leader, the former boss, had been very rude and had favored some of the employees, favored some and devalued others. So that boss was kicked out, and they recruited another one from the group. And that's always tricky to recruit a manager from the group. So they did this. And this boss was a very nice woman, very nice lady who wanted to be liked. So there were some employees that were pretty rude. One of them had really the capacity to harm other employees. So the woman who had made the tape recording, she felt mistreated by some of the other employees. And the boss, she couldn't stop it because she was afraid of that other employee who was sort of a bully. So what we found was that there were some pretty interesting historical facts. This was about really very much about the former leader who had that kind of leadership style, and that kind of communication style, that kind of split in the group was still there, although they had kicked him out. I find it's not very seldom that you can see these kind of things has been going on.
So the problematic employee had identified with the first boss, who was rude and kind of a bully, and the employee that made the complaint was having trouble with the employee who had identified with this boss.
Yeah, who actually knew, because the store had to, this is a company that grew very fast, and he had to recruit people, and he had been a coach in a soccer team. So he recruited people that he already knew from that soccer team. So this is a small town. So everybody is sort of, people know each other all too well sometimes, and have these kind of role conflicts, you know. So the new boss, she was actually friends with half of the group, socializing privately and so on and so forth. And so it's pretty difficult to be a manager then, to sort of say this behavior is not okay in this workplace. She was too afraid to say that to the group. So that kind of behavior was normalized. That kind of rude behavior with people were ridiculed or felt threatened. So the concept of psychological safety in this group was sort of missing. Half of the group never spoke in their meetings. And one person felt that she was a victim, a bully victim, you say in English, yeah?
Yeah, so she, in her wanting to be liked, she really wasn't able to create a safe environment.
Yeah, for all of the employees. And the group was too big. That was another finding. So they had to do something about that to create psychological safety in that group.
So it's a wonderful example of the kind of complexity that you have to address in the work environment and be aware of all the dynamics going on, as well as, you say, the history of the original boss and the impact that had as a kind of unconscious theme.
Yes. Yeah. So when we got to that group, they thought that there was one problem, and that was that woman who had tape record the bars, that if we only could get rid of her, everything would be perfect. So, you know, it's a scapegoat solution on the thing. So it's important to sort of analyze both the structural issues and then the psychological issues. And of course, sometimes also you find a person, an employee or a boss who has personality disorder, for example. Sometimes that is the fact. So you need to address that to help in some way to not deny that kind of fact. This wasn't the case in this. It was more like a group process, malignant group processes going on in this group. But that could be enough to make a life miserable for an employee.
There's been a lot written about the concept of psychological safety and its importance in work groups.
Yes, yes. I think that I don't remember her name, but the researcher who has been studying this for 20 years, she got to read, it was Google who made this big study of psychological safety, because they wanted to know what is it about these teams who are performing so well. It was the issue of psychological safety in those groups that performed very, very well. So I think it's a very interesting concept that managers should really try to understand and to cherish and to help create that kind of psychological safety. So you can both sort of get along and get ahead. So there is room for critical thinking. There is room for voices. There is room for seeing, oh, this is a problem. We cannot do this and this and that. We have to do otherwise. So you have that kind of feeling of loyalty and safety. So you can have that kind of balance as a manager and in the group. So you don't create this basic assumption, fight, flight, or whatever they are. So people are too afraid or have this kind of primitive defense mechanism to defend themselves from that kind of primitive anxiety that can easily raise in groups and big groups. So I think it's really, really important knowledge.
So you're certainly giving us a very good sense of the work that you are doing off the couch. I really appreciate that. I understand from our previous brief conversation that we had that you have some thoughts about the future and the future trends as far as analysis is concerned, as well as the future of consulting work from an analytic standpoint.
As I'm interested sociology and groups and organization, I'm also interested in neuropsychoanalysis. And I think that that kind of work is sort of now catching up with the research that people do in traditional neuroscience. And I'm following a psychologist. She's a researcher. Her name is Lisa Feldman Barrett. And she's doing some really, really interesting work on affects, as the famous Mark Solms, who coined the term neuropsychoanalysis. I think that we are in the sort of beginning of the golden age of understanding more of these subjective and unconscious processes, that you cannot say that you shouldn't be stuck in this psychic reality. You have to sort of address the biological reality and the social reality as well. So it's that kind of broad thinking that I like. We talked a little bit about and last time we spoke that Freud himself was broad in that sense. He worked for 20 years as a neuroscientist, neurologist, and then switched over to psychoanalysis and to do that work. And he was very interested in the end of his life with social science, with the destiny of the mankind, and in his books of civilization and his discontent and the work Moses and the monotheism. And I feel with Freud, I think that's, it's a pity to sort of have that kind of split in the psychoanalytical world to say that, oh, we should only deal with this psychic reality. We shouldn't engage in the other realities, which is the biological reality as well as the social reality. So Lisa Feldman Barrett is really doing some really interesting research in this field, as of course Mark Solms and his fellows and all the other now pretty famous other researchers like Eric Kandel and you know this he's dead now, Jaak Panksepp. So I think it's a pretty interesting time to be around.
Well, thank you for bringing to our attention this other work, and I'm sure that our podcast will have some episodes on neuropsychoanalysis in the not too distant future. But for now, I really want to thank you for a very interesting and enjoyable and informative podcast. I really appreciate your joining us, Anna, and I want to thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.